Am I asleep? Am I awake? Or somewhere in between? I can't believe that you are here and lying next to me. Or did I dream that we were perfectly entwined? Like branches on a tree or twigs caught on a vine.
Like all those days and weeks and months I tried to steal a kiss. And all those sleepless nights and daydreams where I picture this. I'm just the underdog who finally got the girl. And I am not ashamed to tell it to the world.
Truly, madly, deeply, I am foolishly, completely falling. And somehow you kicked all my walls in. So baby, say you'll always keep me. Truly, madly, crazy, deeply in love with you.
Should I put coffee and granola on a tray in bed and wake you up with all the words that I still haven't said? And tender touches just to show you how I feel? Or should I act so cool like it was no big deal?
Wish I could freeze this moment in a frame and stay like this. I'll put this day back on replay and keep reliving it. Cause here's the tragic truth, if you don't feel the same, my heart would fall apart if someone said your name.
Truly, madly, deeply, I am foolishly, completely falling. And somehow you kicked all my walls in. So baby, say you'll always keep me. Truly, madly, crazy, deeply in love with you.
Hope I'm not a casualty. Hope you won't get up and leave. Might not mean that much to you, but to me it's everything.
Be What's up, America? This is DJ Liberty here on Penguin Radio, radio.dominican.edu. We got a great show here for you today with, of course, the usual segments of international political news, then some national political news, and then follow it up and finish it with some California state political news. So let's jump right into it here on radio.dominican.edu. Again, this is DJ Liberty. The truth and reality, it's your liberty, here on Penguin Radio. Now, President Barack Obama has said that a relationship with Vladimir Putin now seems out of reach. As the crisis in Ukraine has dragged on for weeks with no resolution in sight, the relationship between President Obama and Russian President Vladimir Putin seems to have hit a new low. Now, sure, Putin said last week that he was sure Mr. Obama's a courageous and good person would save him if he were drowning, but it appears that any solution to the conflict in the region will likely not be driven to the strength of Mr. Obama and Putin's communication skills. Even after diplomatic talks in Geneva last week yielded the first potential breakthrough to alleviate the rising tension in eastern Ukraine, the president was pessimistic about the prospects for peace. In addition to sounding like he has no faith Russia will change course, the president sounds like he has no faith in his own ability to alter Russia's behavior. Now, the New York Times reported over the weekend that Mr. Obama has abandoned any hope of a good relationship with Putin less than 4 years after he declared a successful reset of U.S.-Russia relations. Now, the Times reports that the president will merely look to minimize the disruption Mr. Putin can cause, preserve whatever marginal cooperation can be saved, and otherwise ignore the master of the Kremlin in favor of other foreign policy areas where progress remains possible. The change comes after Mr. Obama's attempts to coax Putin into calling off pro-Russian forces occupying buildings in eastern Ukraine led nowhere. Descriptions of the phone calls between the two men issued by the White House and the Kremlin often sounded like two entirely different conversations. It was not unlike a phone call between the president and House Majority Leader earlier this week that the president described as very pleasant. The new reality of the Obama-Putin relationship certainly doesn't mean an end to U.S.-Russia relations entirely. The U.S. continues to maintain supply routes to Afghanistan through Russian territory and carry out nuclear inspections under a treaty from the president's first term. And the U.S. must continue to work with Russia on removing chemical weapons from Syria and forging an agreement to rid Iran of its nuclear weapons program. Ukraine has been under control for Russia for about a month and a half now, and I mean, you can totally see that everybody's not in favor of what Russia is doing. Now, Obama has spoken out and said that he thinks there is no way a relationship between himself and Vladimir Putin on a personal level can ever reach any kind of agreement because of what Putin has done with Russia and Ukraine and how he has put his dictatorship into Ukraine and annexed Ukraine from their own country and made it so that Ukraine is under Russia's control. The question that remains is whether further sanctions on key sectors of Russia's economy could shape Putin's behavior at this point. Now, the president said last week that his administration is readying further consequences for Russia's actions. The last round of sanctions is already taking a toll on Russia's economy. And at this point, the administration has made clear it is letting Russia choose its own fate. That's a pretty big hit there for Russia. Obviously, the U.S. posing sanctions on Russian officials is going to hit their economy pretty hard. And like I just said, it leaves Russia's fate in their own hands. Whatever they choose to do here is their choice, and it'll affect their economy and Ukraine's economy directly based on the sanctions we have given them. Now, in other news, Bob Dole, the former Republican presidential nominee, has said that the U.S. should send weapons to Ukraine. And this includes weapons like tanks and soldiers to Ukraine to help it resist Russia's moves on its territory. The 90-year-old Republican Party icon and former U.S. Senate Majority Leader said Putin has sort of sized up. Democratic President Barack Obama and concluded that he's not a strong leader. Dole's comments came as Vice President Joe Biden began a high-profile visit to Ukraine, and only days after an announcement in Geneva that talks between Ukraine, Russia, the United States, and the European Union produced an agreement to take tentative steps toward calming a volatile situation in eastern Ukraine. Last month, Russia annexed the Crimean Peninsula, which had been Ukrainian territory. Dole made his remarks during a reception at the local GOP headquarters in the Kansas City suburb of Overland Park, the first of 10 homecoming receptions in his native state over 3 days. He discussed Ukraine at the prompting of Kansas Republican Governor Sam Brownback, himself a former U.S. senator. Dole has said he scheduled his tour of Kansas to meet with past backers and new supporters, and his event in Overland Park was packed with GOP activists and elected officials, including U.S. Rep. Kevin Yoder, whose district is centered on the Kansas City area. Dole's tour will be in northeast Kansas, but he's already scheduled a second one for May that will include stops in central Kansas cities, including Salina and Wichita. Now, with a Republican leader such as Bob Dole speaking out on the responses of U.S. to Russia's actions in Ukraine, it lies that he is a Republican going against a Democratic president. Of course, there can be party issues and there can be differences in the two parties. And I think a big part of this here is the fact that President Barack Obama is a Democrat and, of course, Bob Dole is a Republican. Now, of course, though, it can also be the complete opinion of Bob Dole that things haven't been handled well in Russia and in Ukraine, and that President Barack Obama is looking like a weaker leader than before when Russia decided to just literally waltz into Ukraine and take over. The fact that Barack Obama has not done anything that has made sufficient consequences against Russia besides the sanctions that were posed against Russian officials by President Barack Obama and Congress show that he may be a weak leader and may not stick up to what he says, stick up to what his word is, what he goes for and what he goes against. The fact that Bob Dole has spoken out here today shows that there is unrest in the country and people are upset with what Obama has done here with the Ukrainian situation, and that there are supporters out there of sending weapons to Ukraine, such as just soldiers and tanks, and resisting the strong forces of Russia. And following that, the Ukrainian Prime Minister says Russia wants to restore the Soviet Union based on what their actions are. As violence between pro-Russian separatists and Ukrainian forces in eastern Ukraine, it continues its deadly turn, Ukrainian Prime Minister blamed Russian President Vladimir Putin on Sunday for fomenting unrest in his country and warned that he's not sure where Putin's designs might lead. Russia triggered this violence and Russia supported these terrorists. Now, the Prime Minister warned that Russia's continued meddling in eastern Ukraine, coming on the heels of its effective seizure of the Crimean Peninsula from Ukraine in March, could speak to far grander ambitions than some in the West are prepared to acknowledge. President Putin has a dream to restore the Soviet Union, and every day he goes further and further, and God knows where is the final destination, he explained. And I believe that you do remember his famous Munich speech saying that the biggest disaster of the former century is the collapse of the Soviet Union. I consider that the biggest disaster of this century would be restoring the Soviet Union under the circumstances of President Putin. Now, the Prime Minister is speaking out here. I don't know if it's kind of against what Putin is going for, but that's kind of what it looks like here with his comments, saying that it's terrible to see that the Soviet Union could come up again and be restored by President Vladimir Putin, and that the restoring of the Soviet Union is a huge, huge mistake and would be a huge disaster to this century. And you can see that the Prime Minister is obviously against it. I don't know if he's necessarily speaking out against Vladimir Putin directly, or if he's just trying to put it out there for the world to hear that, you know, look alive, this is what's happening. Like, you know, Vladimir Putin is out here, and he has stated before that he wants to restore the Soviet Union, so everybody better watch out and be wary that he might just go for it, and this Russian waltz into Ukraine might be the exact thing he needs to restore power and order to Russia to create a new Soviet Union. Now, appearing directly after the Russian Prime Minister's interview, Senator Bob Corker, the Republican from Tennessee, called on the administration to strengthen its sanctions against Russian officials and companies and to begin providing military aid, including hardware and weaponry, to Ukraine. Now, obviously, these remarks made by the Russian Prime Minister do scare the U.S. and just the entire world. And you can see that, just as Senator Corker did, people are wanting to send out military help. And so it needs to be acted upon that Russia can't just become a new Soviet Union under Vladimir Putin. I mean, just as the Prime Minister said, it would be a huge disaster for this century. So hopefully things can get figured out. I know that things need to get figured out before things go way more south than they already have. And just always keeping Ukraine and the inhabitants and the citizens of Ukraine in your thoughts, and you know, wanting a peaceful resolution to this. But, you know, if things are going to continue the way they have, and that if Putin does not back down, then obviously the U.S. and some other countries need to step it up more and act upon it more, and not just impose these silly sanctions that have hurt Russia's economy. However, Putin has just ignored it and just gone for it and is trying to, as the Prime Minister said, maybe create a whole new Soviet Union. And on that, House lawmakers are pushing back on the Ukrainian aid, which actually came before these reports on wanting to create a new Soviet Union. The White House is not going far enough in sending aid to Ukraine, and obviously Russia can see that and feel that, you know, if they're not going to push back hard with us with military affairs or, you know, weapons or anything like that, then let's just keep going for it. If, you know, if they see that the United States are just sending in or just posing sanctions against us, then, you know, we'll take it. And, you know, maybe their thought process is, if we become the new Soviet Union, we can fight those sanctions, we can overpower those sanctions. And if that's what ends up happening, it's going to be bad news for the United States and the rest of the world to have a superpower like what the Soviet Union was. I mean, it's thrown out there. I've thrown it out there a couple of times just because I've heard some people talking about it. But what if another World War III? What a Cold War II? Like, you know, what here is going to happen? What I think we need to act now and stop posing these silly sanctions that are hurting Russia's economy. That's not going to do it. It's obviously not doing anything. Vladimir Putin is pushing even farther into Ukraine, sending even more troops into Ukraine. And you can see more people in the country are speaking out, more political leaders, more so Republican than Democratic. But still, you know, maybe we need to take a weapons stance against Russia and help Ukraine. Send soldiers, send tanks, send weapons, do something to help Ukraine and help the entire world from stopping a soon-to-be, what could be, what's spoken of, new Soviet Union. So with that, I am going to leave you on that dangling note of the scary what-if situation here with Russia, and I will be back with you in just a moment after this quick short break. You know it, we are on the one and only Penguin Radio on radio.dominican.edu. I am DJ Liberty. The truth and reality, it's your liberty, here on radio.dominican.edu.
Keep careful watch of my brother's souls, and should the sky be filled with fire and smoke,
keep watching over your insides. This is to end in fire, then we shall all burn together. Watch the flames climb high into the night, calling out, Father, oh, stand by, and we will watch the flames burn up and on the mountainside. Should die tonight, we should all die together. Raise a glass of wine for the last time, calling out, Father, prepare as we will watch the flames burn up and on the mountainside. Desolation comes upon the sky. Now I see fire inside the mountain. I see fire burning the trees. And I see fire hollow in soul. I see fire blood in the breeze. And I hope that you remember. Close to the flame, calling out, Father, oh, hold fast, and we will watch the flames burn up and on the mountainside. Desolation comes upon the sky. Now I see fire inside the mountain. I see fire.
What's up, everybody? This is DJ Liberty back here on radio.dominican.edu, the one and only Penguin Radio on Political Row, the truth and reality, it's your liberty. Now, we left off talking about the Ukraine crisis again. That's a big international topic that's going on. And now we didn't get to finish some of the other topics that I wanted to cover in the international segment just because the Ukraine crisis is just such a big deal, and I could go on for it for days, so sorry for just rambling, but I also want to touch on a kind of a new topic here, because there's a rising question if the United States missed out on a top Al-Qaeda meeting in Yemen. Now, new questions were being asked Wednesday after a video surfaced showing that looks of a large and dangerous gathering of Al-Qaeda, and this may be the biggest gathering they've seen in years. Now, I can't imagine that they knew about this meeting, but it is scary to see that we might have missed out on it. And U.S. officials aren't commenting on anything, but every frame of the video is now being analyzed as a potential piece of evidence. There are videos here that are showed that could, you know, be exact evidence, direct evidence of Al-Qaeda members meeting in Yemen. And this, as I said, could be the biggest meeting that they've had in years. Analysts are looking at a flashy white truck that appears leading a convoy. They are even analyzing the fruit juice being served as a possible cue. Now, in the middle of the clip, the man known as Al-Qaeda's crown prince, Nasir al-Wahashi, appears brazenly out in the open, greeting followers in Yemen. He is the number two leader of Al-Qaeda globally and the head of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. In a speech to the group, he makes it clear that he's going after the United States, saying, "We must eliminate the cross. The bearer of the cross is America." The video started appearing on jihadist websites recently, drawing the attention of U.S. officials and global terrorism experts. U.S. officials say they believe it's authentic. They believe the highly produced video is recent, with some fighters' faces blurred. There is worry it signals a new round of plotting. Now, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, also known as AQAP, is considered the most dangerous Al-Qaeda affiliate. The CIA and the Pentagon have killed multiple AQAP leaders with drone strikes, but the group is now emboldened. It's unlikely the U.S. wasn't aware of the meeting shown in the video, but it is scary to see that this type of meeting did take place, could have taken place. Sorry, there's no, you know, direct evidence that it did, but there that it was an actual Al-Qaeda meeting. But it is scary to see that it happened. You know, the number two Al-Qaeda leader is out saying to followers in Yemen that he is out to eliminate the cross and that the bearer of the cross is America, so therefore America must be eliminated. That is really scary to hear, especially since this could be the biggest meeting, as I said, that we've seen by Al-Qaeda leaders in years, and it could be a new round of plotting against the United States of America. Now, the high-stakes drone war in Yemen poses another opinion. Over the weekend, the United States launched drone strikes in two different locations in Yemen, killing at least 15 militants as well as three civilians. At the same time, Yemeni ground forces began what have been termed unprecedented operations against Al-Qaeda's affiliate in Yemen, which may also involve additional U.S. drone strikes, although that isn't clear as of now. The U.S. drone campaign in Yemen is very much President Obama's war. Unlike in Pakistan, where President George W. Bush significantly ramped up the CIA drone campaign while he was in office, there was only one drone strike in Yemen during Bush's two terms in office. During Obama's administration, there have been 92 drone attacks. I'll say that again, 92 compared to George W. Bush's one. And as well as a further 15 U.S. strikes using other forms of weaponry, such as cruise missiles and other missiles that can be launched from a higher altitude for a direct impact on targets. Indeed, Obama vastly accelerated the drone campaign in Yemen in 2011-2012, just as CIA drone strikes in Pakistan began to slow. Now, 47 strikes took place in Yemen in 2012, marking the first time the number of drone strikes in Yemen and Pakistan reached comparable levels. One reason for this acceleration in drone strikes in Yemen may have been Obama's authorization in April 2012 of the signature strikes that had been approved the previous year for use in Pakistan's tribal regions. Such strikes do not target known militants, but rather people who were displaying the behaviors of suspected militants. Such signature strikes were reportedly governed by stricter rules in Yemen than in Pakistan, though, and were given a different name, TADS, or Terrorist Attack Disruption Strikes. And as of Monday, U.S. drone and airstrikes have killed an estimated 753 to 965 people in Yemen, of whom the large majority were militants, but at least 81 were civilians. All but six of the many hundreds of victims of the strikes were killed under the Obama administration. The drone program in Yemen began in earnest after a series of attempted terrorist attacks against the United States were traced back to Al-Qaeda's Yemen-based affiliate, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. So this obviously shows that, you know, President Obama and the Obama administration see that there are things going on in Yemen that need to be adhered to, and, you know, these drone strikes are kind of scary because they're killing a lot of people, and not only just militants, but civilians. I mean, there was a huge number between 700 to mid-700s to mid-900s of people being killed in Yemen, and 81 of those reportedly were civilians. That's a terrible number to hear because obviously, you know, the U.S. policy with the military is to never ever kill someone who is unarmed, to never ever kill a civilian. So that's kind of scary. So that ends the international segment there. Sorry, I ran into the national segment, but we will jump straight into the national segment here as Obama has named W. Neil Eggleston the new White House counsel. President Obama will name him as the successor to White House counsel Catherine Ruemmler, who is stepping down next month. Eggleston is currently a partner at the law firm Kirkland & Ellis and is best known for his work defending government officials under investigation ranging from Chicago mayor and former Obama chief of staff Rahm Emanuel to former White House political affairs director Sarah Taylor, who was questioned in connection to the mass firing of several U.S. attorneys. Neil brings extraordinary expertise, credentials, and experience to our team, Mr. Obama said in a statement according to the New York Times. He has a passion for public service, is renowned for his consciousness and foresight, and I look forward to working closely with him in the coming years. Now, Ruemmler, who served under Mr. Obama longer than any other counsel, plans to step down in mid-May after several previous attempts to depart the position, and Eggleston will start his new position in mid-May. He worked in the counsel's office during former President Clinton's tenure before moving to the private sector. After attending Duke University and Northwestern University School of Law, Eggleston clerked for then Chief Justice Warren Burger and served as a federal prosecutor in the Southern District of New York. So that's some big news there, that we've got a White House counsel member stepping down, and President Barack Obama has used one of his enumerated powers to appoint a new White House councilman. And it's, you know, it's great to see that he's active and he's making these steps to appoint W. Neil Eggleston. And in other news, it's kind of amusing. Chris Christie has been named Father of the Year. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie has been named Father of the Year by the National Father's Day Mother's Day Council. The Republican governor has four children ranging from ages 10 to 20. He often talks about them in public, and Chrissy has joked that having dinner with all of them has given him experience in being yelled at and has boasted about having a rare family, one without video games. Chrissy attracted scrutiny in 2011 when he used a state police helicopter to fly his son Andrew's baseball game, and he actually repaid the cost. However, the other honoree so far this year is shoe designer Vince Camuto. Over the years, most of the honorees have been well known. This list includes former President Bill Clinton and professional basketball star Shaquille O'Neal. It's funny to see Chris Christie's name thrown in there with former President Bill Clinton and professional basketball star Shaquille O'Neal. Never thought they'd be on the same list together, but hey, you never know who's going to end up on the Father of the Year list, named by the National Father's Day, Mother's Day Council. And so we will immediately shift topics off of that to the Keystone delay, which has put red state Democrats in some sort of a bind. The Obama administration's announcement Friday that it will extend its Keystone pipeline review, further postponing a final decision on the controversial project, has drawn bipartisan outrage from Capitol Hill lawmakers. The apparent stalling over whether to approve the crude oil conduit, which supporters say would create jobs and boost the country as an energy leader, and opponents say would harm the environment, figures to be a feature in this year's midterms, as states eager to exploit their energy resources also happen to be hosting Senate races that could help determine the balance of power in the chamber. The reason cited by the State Department for needing more time for its review is litigation in the Nebraska Supreme Court over the proposed route of the pipeline in that state. Friday's announcement placed a particular spotlight on the Senate's Energy Committee Chairwoman, Mary Landrieu, who is facing a tough re-election bid in Louisiana this fall. Now, her committee post is a key selling point of her campaign, and Republicans hoping to flip her seat are using the delay to spotlight her apparent lack of clout with the administration. Republican campaigning against the three-term lawmaker argue that the delay indicates she has little influence on administration decisions. The delay gives the president more time, and possibly until after the midterm elections, to decide the fate of the project, which has put him between his environmentally friendly voter and donor base, vulnerable red state Democrats like Landrieu. Some lawmakers signaled that they would go around Obama if necessary, which would then put Majority Leader Harry Reid in a tight spot between his at-risk members and the party base. So you can see that President Obama is obviously, I mean, Obama and his administration are acting upon what they think is best for the country. And however, it has put some red state Democrats in a little bit of a struggle here, as seen by the reports in Louisiana. It's, you know, it's helpful to the Republicans because now they can use this to, as I said, flip a seat in Congress and maybe gain some seats there and show that, you know, the Democrats are not a party that's together, are not a party that's helping each other, and, you know, not a party that's connecting the Democrats to the Republicans to aid the country in more, you know, finding one little issue with, you know, the president and his administration against what his party or base thinks or feels or needs to help the country, and completely ignoring what the Republicans think. So it could go back and forth multiple ways, and unfortunately it's put some people in a bind for their seat in Congress and other lawmakers who want to obviously get reelected this midterm election year. And so now we will shift over to a Supreme Court decision that turns away Rick Scott on an appeal for a drug testing order. The U.S. Supreme Court refused Monday to hear an appeal by Florida Governor Rick Scott on his 2011 executive order that would have required random drug tests for as many as 85,000 state workers. The ruling let stand an appeals court decision that Scott's order was too broad. That decision also directed a Miami federal judge to oversee ongoing negotiations between the state and an employee union over which positions could be subjected to random drug tests. The Supreme Court's refusal to hear the appeal follows a similar decision in late December by a federal judge in Orlando who struck down a Florida law requiring applicants for welfare benefits to undergo mandatory drug testing. Scott, a Republican, is also appealing that case. The American Civil Liberties Union of Florida, which challenged both drug testing plans as unconstitutional, said federal courts have clearly rejected blanket mandatory drug testing by the state. The ACLU represents the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees Council 79, which covers about 34,000 of the state workers that Scott originally sought to subject to random drug testing. Now, it could take another 10 months to finish the process, but by then voters will have decided whether to give Scott another 4 years in office or replace him with a new Democrat, either former Governor Charlie Crist or former State Senator Nan Rich. Scott issued a statement saying state employees should have the right to work in a safe and drug-free environment just like in any other business. The governor noted that portions of the case are still being debated in Miami federal court and that he would continue to fight for expanded employee drug testing. Meanwhile, the governor's office has a May 5th deadline to file its appeal in the welfare benefits drug testing case with the 11th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. That's an interesting touchy subject there, because obviously you don't want a working environment that has people on drugs, using illegal drugs, illegal substances, while in a working environment. However, it also comes down to the Supreme Court and their decision to hear an appeal for it against, you know, other decisions that have been made. So it's back and forth, and unfortunately it's a sticky subject, almost like anything else in politics. So we'll see where the Supreme Court and the federal courts go from there in Miami, and we'll take it from there. Hopefully I can provide some more news and updates on what will happen with that. And now, on an interesting note, the White House on the petition to deport Justin Bieber has provided no comment. It's been a big deal lately with Justin Bieber under some law-breaking actions made talks rise that, you know, a deportation is in line. However, the White House has two words for those who want President Barack Obama to deport Justin Bieber: no comment. Nearly 275,000 people signed an internet petition calling the Canadian-born teen idol reckless and asking Obama to revoke his green card. That's far more than required to merit an official response through the White House's We the People program. The White House says it's sorry to disappoint, but it won't be commenting. It's citing a caveat that lets the White House decline to address certain petitions. To avoid the appearance of improper influence, the White House may decline to address certain procurement, law enforcement, adjunctory, or similar matters properly within the jurisdiction of federal departments or agencies, federal courts, or state and local governments in its response to a petition, explains a note on the White House petition website laying out the system's terms of participation. But the White House is using the occasion to argue that an immigration overhaul could shrink deficits by nearly $1 trillion over two decades. The White House says that's equivalent to 12.5 billion concert tickets or 100 billion copies of Bieber's debut album. So there's a little interesting, you know, news story here to liven up this political show here on Penguin Radio. Now, that is going to do it for the national segment here on Penguin Radio on radio.dominican.edu. We're going to take a quick short break here, and we'll come back with some California state news. So stay tuned here on Political Row with me, DJ Liberty. The truth and reality, it's your liberty, here on radio.dominican.edu.
I feel a filth in my bones. Wash off my hands till it's gone. The walls, they're closing in with velvet curtains. Some love was made for the lights. Some kiss your cheek and goodnight. Lift up a red high heel. lock up your doors with steel. They're making noise in my street. My blinds are drawn, I can't see. Smashed in my car window, didn't touch the stereo. Slow it down, Angie, come back to bed. Rest your arms and rest your legs.
What's up, America? This is DJ Liberty back here on Penguin Radio on radio.dominican.edu. Now we are going to finish this week's show with some California state news. First, to start it off, California Governor Jerry Brown grants dozens of drug pardons. Now, California Governor Jerry Brown has granted 63 individuals some pardons, many of whom have been convicted of minor drug offenses. More than 40 of the pardoned individuals had been convicted on charges of possessing, selling, or manufacturing controlled substances, including marijuana. Some of them are now active in public service, serving as drug counselors or supporting nonprofits. Clark William Guest, who served 60 days in jail and 5 years of probation after stealing from his landlord to support his methamphetamine habit, was among those pardoned. As Brown's pardon notes, Guest is now the coordinator of the drug rehabilitation program he participated in following his conviction. In each notice, Brown wrote that the pardoned individuals had lived an honest and upright life, exhibited good moral character, and conducted themselves as law-abiding citizens. While a pardon does not expunge a conviction from the individual's record, it does restore certain rights, such as serving on a jury. As the Sacramento Bee notes, Brown's announcement came on Good Friday, which is consistent with the Catholic governor's past pattern of timing pardons with the Christian holidays. Previously, the governor has granted pardons around Christmas and Easter. Last Christmas, Brown announced 127 pardons, including 93 drug-related convictions. So that's an interesting little take on Governor Jerry Brown's kind of not habit, but just want to grant some pardons to some individuals he feels have lived an upright and, you know, good life, and feels that they should be pardoned for things that they have served time for and have made that known because of their involvement in public service and whatnot. So now we will switch gears to the ever ongoing talks of Leland Yee as he pleads not guilty to corruption and conspiracy charges. Now, suspended state senator Leland Yee and several of his alleged conspirators on Tuesday pleaded not guilty to federal corruption and illegal firearms charges. Keith Jackson, a former Yee consultant and one of 29 defendants in the case, also pleaded not guilty at a joint arraignment before U.S. Judge Joseph C. Sparrow, another major subject in the federal probe. Raymond Shrimp Boy Chow was also allowed to postpone his plea after his new attorney, Tony Serra, asked for more time. Yee, a San Francisco Democrat who was running for his party's nomination for Secretary of State until he was arrested and charged last month, was expressionless as he walked up to the front of the courtroom with attorney James A. LaSerrat. Sparrow read the charges to him and their potential penalties and asked if Yee understood. Yee simply replied, "I do." Prosecutors assert that Jackson introduced Yee to several undercover agents posing as people seeking political favors in exchange for donations to Yee's campaigns for San Francisco mayor in 2011 and Secretary of State in 2014. This is an ongoing topic here with Leland Yee because of his drastic charges that have been filed against him, as he was charged for many, many different things, one being human trafficking, guns trafficking, involvement with the triads. It just, the list goes on with so many other people involved and with so much evidence. And as I just said, Leland Yee has pleaded not guilty. And now for our last news story here on Political Row. Proposal offers loans to undocumented students at California universities. Seeking to close a gap undocumented students face in funding their education, State Senator Ricardo Lara, the Democrat from Bell Gardens, has proposed a new loan program for California's public universities. Senate Bill 1210 would make available $9.2 million for University of California and California State University campuses to administer loans to undocumented students who are ineligible for federal financial aid and most private loans. California has already taken several steps over the past 13 years to make college available and more affordable for undocumented students. In 2001, the legislature extended in-state tuition to undocumented immigrants who graduated from a California high school. 3 years ago, it made them eligible to apply for Cal grants. But undocumented students at the news conference said that can still leave them thousands of dollars short to cover costs such as housing, books, transportation, and food. Lara was joined at the event by Sacramento State President Alexander Gonzalez and UC President Janet Napolitano, who said the university stands strongly behind this bill to put undocumented students on equal footing with their peers. She estimated there are 2,000 undocumented students in the UC system who could benefit from the loan program. Her appointment as UC president last fall was strongly opposed by campus immigration activists. UC Berkeley law students planned another protest for Wednesday evening outside an event where Napolitano was scheduled to attend. Now, obviously, this idea, this bill to aid the undocumented students in the California system for UCs and California State Universities is very back and forth. Again, has to do a lot with immigration and funding for the state and taxes and where this funding is coming from and, you know, paying for I don't want to say illegal, but just, you know, people who shouldn't, you know, who shouldn't have the just the grant to go to school on other people's money and do it so where they don't have to pay much. And, you know, they did become eligible for Cal Grants 3 years ago, and now it's looking to become even easier for them to go to school here in California at a UC or a Cal State through this new bill that is being proposed. So we will see where that goes, and of course I will keep all of my listeners updated. On that note, I want to thank my listeners for tuning in to my show, Political Row, on Penguin Radio on radio.dominican.edu. And I want to thank family and friends as well. I love you guys and I miss you guys, and I'll be home soon. Probably, you know, less than a month here. We got less than a month of school to go. So here in the home stretch, thank you everybody for listening. And I will tune in here next week for Political Row on radio.dominican.edu, the one and only Penguin Radio. The truth and reality, it's your fantasy. Thank you, everybody. Good night.